right back where we started. That's Zen for you. Shitto, we said, brings us back to the marketplace, back to the charcoal fire, to our ordinary lives. What's that like if you spent some time turning the mind around, seeing delusions rise and fall and rise again, like anything else that rises and falls in that big stillness or as it? In no, there's no going and coming. In no, there's only going and coming. Since I realized what was not born, Song of Realizing the Way says, which sounds like a pretty big deal, which it is, or it isn't. You pick up your projections, dust them off a little, and get back in the game. With luck, you regard your projections a little differently. You don't let them push you around quite so much, and maybe you don't use them to push others around quite so much either. Tough and bony bodies is how Song of Realizing the Way describes you. So understatement might be more appropriate than hyperbole here. In that spirit, here are a couple of not from the Zen tradition evocations of similar experiences and their effects. In the romantic poet Shelley's Prometheus Unbound, there's a descent to the realm of something called Demigorgon, where we realize, or don't not realize, that the deep truth is imageless. Sound familiar? Back in the world of the bright, it turns out that all is slightly changed. The critic Harold Bloom loves that slightly, as I do. He calls it urbane. When you get back to New Jersey, don't hop up and down stomping your feet about how you've seen Paris, just because Jersey feels a little different now. Case two. The anthropologist Mary Douglas says that cultures regard as taboo those creatures and objects that don't fit their category systems, that seem to sit awkwardly right on the boundary between X and Y, scrambling or destabilizing the culture's organizing models. Look out, it's neither X nor Y, don't eat it. For the Lele tribe, the pangolin, an armored anteater, is the most deeply taboo of all. It destabilizes umpteen XY categories. It's apparently on the boundary between all these different, you know, ways of categorizing things. So of course, the most esoteric mystical cult in the tribe involves eating the pangolin once a year and experiencing all your culture's categories fall into emptiness. Also sound familiar? But at that point, you don't run off and become a hippie or stomp through the village eating pangolins. You just go back to obeying the dietary rules and other tribal mores. But maybe all is slightly changed. This slight change is a product of going back to observing village customs having been shifted by your pangolin moment, a shift you don't have to keep in the foreground for it to go on working. That's one beautiful aspect of Shitto's like front foot and back foot walking as an image for the cooperative interaction of a sense of emptiness and a sense of form, or bright and dark. You don't need a lot of big machinery to keep switching the stage set. Slide in the bright landscape. Quick, slide in the dark one now. You just walk. Though Shitto does set up what seems to be some stage machinery, cosmic darkness, stuff that interpermeates but also stands in its own place, and so on, it's good to remember that he's writing a poem, and therefore to some extent probably traffics in metaphors. I'm suggesting that is that it might be helpful, a la what Fred was saying last night about a Thich Nhat Hanh exercise, to regard the different modes or aspects of reality laid out in Shitto's poem through something of a Lankavatara perspective, or maybe Lanka light. If not quite projections only, then projections partly. This might lighten up our sense of Shitto's worldview, if that's what it is, a little. How might it be helpful to consider Shitto's poem not as a metaphysical treatise, but from a Jamesian perspective, as proffering multiple competing or complementary models for our consideration in the hope that each one might prove useful in the appropriate circumstances? If we're taking a Jamesian tack, we might regard each model as something we can use to see the world through because it makes available to us some aspect of reality which it would be helpful to be in touch with. But we would also want to see through each model in the other sense as partly a projection we don't want to be totally hoodwinked by. The model has its use, but also its limitations, bringing certain aspects of reality into focus, but obscuring others. So maybe Shinto is purposely pluralist, proposing each model not just for its own truth value, but also to liberate us from the limitations of the other models. If a picture can hold us captive, maybe it's helpful to have more than one picture of the same thing, and as Martha suggested, to invite ourselves to be captivated by it, but maybe not all the time. Let's start with the emptiness model, more particularly with the interwoven or interweaving aspect of it. There's enough Tao of physics material out there, which I'm sure most of you are at least as familiar with as I am, to suggest that seeing reality as endless interpermeation is a model with a utility that's not limited to Zennies. So in James's terms, this model, or something like it, stands as relatively true or true in so far forth. It's a useful account that might not be superseded by physicists anytime soon. We can lend it some trust, which perhaps makes us feel better about taking it into our practice. At the same time, from another Jamesian vantage, it's a useful model because it helps free us from the tyranny of a common sense view of things, which we mostly take for granted. I'm over here, you're over there, I run over you and score a touchdown, or you tackle me and I don't. Welcome to the Nirmanakaya. There's a sense of free fall as you feel the Nirmanakaya world model go poof, at least for a while, a moment where not knowing is most intimate. I also think there's some advantage, as we let ourselves be captivated by this new interpermeation model, in continuing to recognize it as a model, as projection partly. For one thing, that helps slow down our natural human tendency to turn our views into worldviews, to be Buddhist dogmatists about the one thing that's really real. I also think that if you convince yourself that interpermeating emptiness is the essence of reality, you're more likely to get fixated and tense, trying to dynamite all your other ways of seeing the world out of the way once and for all. You can be determined to banish all your other models, which now seem like bad ones that are blocking you from finally realizing the essential emptiness of things, an ultimate truth that maybe remains frustratingly just out of sight, damn it. But if you think of interpermeation as a model you agree to entertain for a while, it's like a pair of corrective lenses you put on, which naturally enough take a little getting used to. Eventually, though, the world starts coming into focus and looks and feels a little, or maybe a lot, different than it did before. Welcome to the emptiness view. So you're just trying to accustom yourself to a new way of seeing, not demanding to grab hold of an ultimate reality which remains remote and forbidding. It's a gentler approach, perhaps making your sense of yourself and the world softer. You also get to take the lenses off, or the world knocks them off for you. What happened? I'm not seeing interpermeation anymore. Help! Well, not to worry. You'll probably find your glasses again. The same array of approaches, I think, might be a good way to hold Shinto's other stories, though I won't trudge through how this might work in similar detail, but fairly quickly. What about stuff standing in its own place, blam, not as an instance of this or that category, but startlingly as just itself? Suzuki's Ri, the absolute incarnate, or Hakuin's formless form coming into form. On the one hand, that's an eruptive, quintessentially Zen antidote to the dreamy vaporousness which an awareness of interpermeation can often induce. Nothing wrong with that, but you might not want to hang out there forever. It shows us that the vastness is right here now, in that cactus, that crow, that plastic window tassel lifted and floating in the soft breeze, in you, in me. This blam eruption of that cactus or that person is also an antidote to Nirmanakaya utilitarianism or the Trumpist transactional view. Person X doesn't exist simply in order to be of use to you or as a nuisance you brush off or a menace you eradicate. An eruption of emptiness right up into form, it has, as Suzuki says, an absolute value, and it makes an absolute claim on you. Look out for the streetcar. Pay your bills. Don't let that person mistreat you like that. If I get a dollar more, you get a dollar less. In the bright, we divide clear speech from confusion, and good words and bad words are not the same. We're not too likely to forget this nirmanakaya aspect for too terribly long, but when it inevitably returns, we might think that's a bummer, we're coming down. Perhaps that's because emptiness can feel so freeing, or because when we lose that view of things, it feels like we're right back where we started, which we are, but aren't, because it's not our only perspective, and we see through it in the double sense we've been talking about. Meanwhile, welcome back to being a regular person. As Joan used to say, you can't leap over your life. Old people like me often have a lot of pairs of glasses they use for different purposes, so the eyewear metaphor comes naturally. But I hope this take on Shitto's multifaceted world as inviting us to inhabit multiple perspectives rather than dogmatically proposing multiple metaphysical realms is, well, useful. That all our models are projections, but, well, not quite only, might be good medicine for people who want to move around the world in its frequently billiard ball aspect, in which the claims of oneness, interpermeation, and nothing hindering anything else sometimes need to take a back seat, and we need to have models that work okay in the nirmanakaya. Look out for that train. Look out for that American demagogue. I think multiple models might be just what the doctor ordered for negotiating this nirmanakaya world without losing our sense that it's also the world of emptiness and interpermeation, mysterious and ineffable, and that it's both these worlds and more worlds at once and all the time. I think such Dharma pluralism is a pretty good deal, preferable anyway to falling into the delusion of regarding some one way of seeing things as the whole ball of wax. Well, that's one possible model of Shitto's model. Sorry, not quite done. I want to spend a few minutes talking about a passage from Kosho Uchiyama's How to Cook Your Life, From the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment, which is a commentary on Dogen's instructions for the Zen cook. What I like about it is that as I ponder it, its projection-only perspective turns out to open into a sense of intimacy and tenderness. This is startling because the sense of consciousness and self the passage evokes seems at first to suggest just the opposite, that each of us is trapped in a solipsistic world created by our particular individual consciousness and that there's no way out. And here's the Uchiyama. The world as experienced is the world which the self alone, you alone, can experience. When looking at the cup, you see it with your eyes, from your angle, and with your vision, while I see it from my angle and with my power of vision. There is no possibility of exchanging even our separate ways of looking at a cup. None of your personal experiences can ever be the same as anyone else's. More so, then, is your way of thinking bound to be different from anyone else's. When you are born, your world is born with you, and when you die, so dies your entire world. This fills me with sadness, but also tenderness. The Diamond Sutra, like a bubble, a thought, a dream. But Uchiyama's passage may also suggest a kind of inescapable remoteness, you in your world, me in mine, like ships passing in the night or bubbles floating past one another. The regular old nirmanakaya sense of things might seem simpler and preferable. We meet in the neutral space of the real world, you over there, me here, and transact our business, which might even be friendly. But I find Uchiyama's picture captivating. For one thing, it suggests the dreamlike quality of our worlds, their emptiness, and also their evanescence. It feels elegiac, which softens things. It also suggests that we remain mysteries to each other, which might lead to thoughtfulness, respect, or even a sense of reverence. Not knowing is most intimate. The you who enters my world, whenever I become aware of your presence, is also always a projection. I know that what I see in you, or what I think you're up to, likely tells me as much about me and the qualities and characteristics of Tennyland as it does about you. So, more mystery. And, one would hope, more self-reflection. We're talking about projection then, also in a narrower, more modern psychology sense. "You're always so aggressive," thinks it's an assertion about you, but might instead show me something I need to consider and shift about this world that's born with me, that I always inhabit, and that will die when I die. What's it like to live there? Do I want to spend my whole life in a place like this? And would you? When you enter my world, I'm the host and you're the guest. In a way, I should say that my projection of you enters my world, but in another sense, you really do. You may be a mystery to me, and what I see may be a product of my projections, but projection only doesn't deny that when I hit you on the head, the real you's head really hurts. Ditto for the whole emotive realm. Entering Tennyland ought to be an experience I'd want you to have, and it's my world, I'm the host here, so I'm largely responsible for that and for how my projection of you may shape your experience there. Meanwhile, I enter your world in which I'm your projection. That's the Linji host-guest dance, and we can hope to dance it with some grace and gentleness. So I think Uchiyama's dreamlike projection-only school model has something to recommend it. You don't need to be captivated by it forever, but it might be useful to lend yourself to it from time to time. And then here are two small practices you might take up if you choose to spend more time there, and then I'm done. So one is just the simple, you know, you're a guest in my world, I'm a guest in your world as a practice. The other one, which I mentioned a few years ago, is my own sort of quirky version of not to from the trust in mind. So, you know, when you want to criticize something, you say not to, in the sense of not one, but not two. You know, we're not one, but we're not two either. And so I was walking around with that, it got a little abstract, and I started doing things like saying, that's Tenny as Connie. That's Tenny as Jen. That's Tenny as Alok. So in some way, I'm seeing myself in you and also knowing that I'm seeing a projection. And there you come, all the same, you know. So it both sort of heals the you over here, me over here, excuse me, you over there, you know, and the sense that, you know, I know all about you. So I think that's it for now. We talked a couple nights ago about turning the recorder off and then back on again, and, you know, chatting about maybe any little practices that we have that we would like to share. They might be about working with our views. They might be about ways to inhabit, you know, the worlds of both emptiness and form, or one and manyness at the same time, or they might be anything else. And we decided also that based on the recording, you know, depending on how it goes, we might just say, oh, it didn't work out. But one thing we might do is I'll sit down with somebody else and, you know, maybe listen to the recording and jot down stuff that seemed like transportable practices. And with advance permission from the people who said those things, we could put them in a tiny little booklet and send it out to people. That may not materialize, but it's at least one possibility. And then I thought also, you know, if anybody wants to ask or say anything about the talk tonight, that we could just mix and mingle that in with the other stuff. So does that sound all right? All right, thank you. So I'm going to turn off the recording and start it right up again.